Hi, everybody. This is Fred Reich. I'm a partner with the Drinker, Biddle & Reef law firm, and I chair the ERISA Financial Services team, meaning the group of attorneys here who represent service providers to plans. With me from our Washington, D.C. office is Brad Campbell. Brad is a former Assistant Secretary of the Department of Labor for the Employee Benefits Security Administration. In other words, during the last Bush administration, he held the position that Phyllis Borzy now has. And as a result, Brad has been a part of the internal process and knows how it works. Just a couple of quick housekeeping things. First, this is a reminder that all of these presentations are put on our website. And in a matter of maybe 3 business days or so, this will be posted on our firm website. For those of you who enjoyed it and either want to re-listen to it or you want to refer it to your comrades, this is pretty easy to remember, but you can make a note. It's www.drinkerbiddle, one word, drinkerbiddle.com/beltway. So we made it very easy. Now, to make it even easier, this presentation has been posted, obviously it's being recorded, once it's posted, everybody who registered for the program, regardless of whether you're actually on today or not, this applies to all of them, you'll get an email. So you get an email saying, hey, it's up there now. You can go look at it if you want, or you can forward the email to some of your compatriots. I particularly want to thank Matt Tixis, who has supported these presentations. This takes a certain hard dollar cost, and it takes time and energy away from the legal work for clients. And that Tixis has been wonderful about sponsoring the program and helping us with that. And Jim Dolan is the representative. Jim, I think you might want to say a thing or two.
Thank you very much, Fred. I appreciate it. Grateful for the partnership, and we're glad to help make sure these calls happen. My name is Jim Dolan. I'm the Vice President with our Retirement Strategies Group at Natixis Global Asset Management. For those of you who aren't familiar with our firm, we are a multi-affiliate organization with more than 20 specialized investment managers. You may be familiar with Loomis Sayles, Harris Associates, and the Oakmark Funds. Some exciting news that I'm excited and proud to share with you is recently Barron's has recognized our firm as the top mutual fund family for 2013. So very exciting. And for those of you who would like to learn more about our firm, please go to durableportfolios.com. And with that, Fred, back to you.
Well, Jim, thank you very much, and congratulations on that award. That's great. Let's jump into the part that Brad and I know the most about. What's going on? What are the current developments across the board affecting retirement plans? And the first couple of months of the year were kind of boring. A lot has happened more recently. The first subject, though, although we will have some current developments on it, but the first subject actually had its genesis in December of 2013, in a manner of speaking, in 2005. This is the top new issue that clients are calling me about and that I'm working with people on. It's about rollover IRAs. The reason it's significant is because of the aging of the baby boomers and a defined contribution world, and literally trillions are projected to roll over into IRAs over the next 10 years. So there's an enormous movement of money going on, and it is in the process of becoming more highly regulated. So what was my reference to 2005? Well, in 2005, the Department of Labor issued an advisory opinion that, in a nutshell, said advisors who are not fiduciaries to plans can capture rollovers without much regulation at all, very little actually. But if you're a fiduciary to a plan, either because you're advising plans or advising participants as a fiduciary, and you want to capture rollovers, you're walking on eggshells in the sense that you really need to do it right or you can get in trouble. 8 years went by from 2005 till the end of last year with everybody believing that that was the way the law worked, generally, the law. But in December, FINRA issued Regulatory Notice 13-45. As a starting point, you have to realize whenever we're talking about rollovers, there's actually two steps. There's the distribution, and then there's the money in the IRA and the investing of the IRA. But all this guidance I'm going to talk about today, in my opinion at least, focuses primarily on the distribution, that is, the withdrawing of money from a plan, much less so on the investing of the money in the IRA. So the FINRA guidance starts off by saying, with regard to distributions, there's two ways that advisors can approach them. They can either provide education, or they can make recommendations to participants that they take distributions. By the way, I think these same concepts apply for that DOL guidance about fiduciaries. So I think we have FINRA, the SEC, and the DOL all saying, you really got to watch that distribution side, and you have to make a decision whether you're going to provide education about distributions or whether you're going to make recommendations about distributions. And in doing that, if you're going to take the education route, you have to provide unbiased, relatively thorough information about the considerations for four alternatives. Leaving the money in the current employer's plan is number one. Number two is transferring it to the plan of a new employer if you're not retiring, if you're going to continue working. Number three is taking a distribution and rolling it to an IRA, either a direct or indirect rollover. And number four is taking a taxable distribution and paying taxes. Now, y'all might be thinking, nobody'd ever take a taxable distribution for an account of any real value. That's wrong. Particularly if you have appreciated company stock, either leaving the money in the old plan or taking a taxable distribution can be the right way to go in terms of the best tax-affected result. There are all these considerations that a participant should make in deciding which one of those four alternatives to make. If you go the education route, then you want written materials to educate participants on what those are and what the major advantages and disadvantages of each of the alternatives are. In other words, you've got to act in the best interest of educating the participant, not in your own best interest. If you go that route, what's the benefit? Well, FINRA said, well, gee, if you're providing education, yeah, your educational services have to be supervised by the broker-dealer. But it's not a recommendation, and therefore, you don't have to worry about what I'm going to talk about now. FINRA went on to say, however, if you make a recommendation, that's an investment recommendation. Well, how can a recommendation about a distribution be an investment recommendation? What FINRA says is inherent in a recommendation to a participant to take a distribution from a defined contribution plan, a participant-directed defined contribution plan, is a recommendation that they liquidate all the investments in the account, convert it to cash, and take it out of the plan. That liquidation of the investments in their 401k or 403b account is, in the eyes of FINRA, a securities recommendation, and therefore it is subject to the suitability standard. So, if you're subject to the suitability standard, and if you're an advisor, a fiduciary advisor, probably the prudent man, or perhaps the prudent man fiduciary standard, what do you look at? What do you have to look at? In the FINRA guidance 1345, it says you got to compare the four alternatives and the advantages and disadvantages of each, and then it gives you a partial list of factors to consider. There's seven factors that are listed in there. We don't have time to get into all that today, but it has seriously ratcheted up the requirements for compliance and making recommendations to take distributions. We're helping clients put a lot of these things in writing so that they can be delivered to participants. To top it off, both the SEC and FINRA, so both RIAs and broker-dealers, now for the 2014 examination priorities, SEC and FINRA have listed rollovers to IRAs as being on their top examination priorities for the upcoming year. So they're taking this very seriously. On top of this all, the DOL is working on a fiduciary advice proposal, as you all know, and it's widely anticipated that it will have some language in there about rollovers as well. Is it possible that they could take the FINRA position that a recommendation to take a distribution is also an investment recommendation to liquidate your account and therefore a fiduciary act? Possibly. Yeah, sure. We don't know. I'm not saying it will be. I'm not saying it won't. But I'm saying that's all out there now for consideration. So what are your takeaways? Look at education versus recommendations. We're in a very gray area now. We're all walking on thin ice on this issue. Education is a much easier route to go. If you have the right written materials, if they're unbiased, and if they cover the material points of advantages and disadvantages. Either way, though, you should, even if you're going to make recommendations rather than education, you should have a discussion of the advantages and disadvantages you can give to the participants. That is a critical factor in this whole process. And then you have to act in the best interest of the participants. If it's better for them to leave the money in the plan, then the recommendation ought to be that they leave it there. If it's better that they take it out and you have a prudent or suitable recommendation to that effect, that's fine. Having said that, Brad, that's sort of what I wanted to say about the FINRA guidance out there. Do you have any comments? I know you're aware of some other things that are going on. Do you want to bring that up now?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Fred. And again, thanks all of you for taking the time to join us. The interest in IRAs and rollovers just keeps growing among various government entities. There is potential legislation on the Hill people are working on to clarify what disclosures would need to be provided in connection with a rollover. Of course, you've got the Department of Labor wading into this area through the fiduciary regulation, where they already are seeking to change the standards that would apply to IRAs and may well do more with connection to IRA rollovers. And the Government Accountability Office has been issuing a number of reports that are critical of the current process. And one of the things the GAO reports have been highlighting in particular is the difficulty of plan-to-plan rollovers compared to the relative ease of plan-to-IRA rollovers. And that's something GAO says should be fixed. And it's our understanding that actually the Treasury Department will probably be shortly issuing some sort of guidance or taking other steps to address exactly that and try and sort of smooth some of the rough edges that are there in the process for doing a rollover from plan to plan. And it just highlights that across the government, this is an issue that's getting a great deal of scrutiny for a couple of reasons. One, we're expecting more and more activity in this space, particularly as people, the baby boomers come near retirement. But secondly, the amount of assets that are in IRAs has now actually exceeded the amount of assets that are in ERISA plans. And so it's an area, or at least in defined contribution and defined benefit pension plans. And so there's a number of reasons why that's happening, but it highlights, along with what FINRA is doing and what the SEC is doing, that this is an area where we're going to see a lot more governmental activity, primarily in the regulatory and enforcement side.
Yeah, interestingly, I think there's a bias among all of these agencies for keeping the money inside retirement plans. And I think the bias is predicated, at least in part, on the lower cost. That thinking that if a participant takes a rollover to an IRA, they may be hurt by conflicts of interest, and that the odds are even that they would be hurt by higher costs. I think, in addition to explaining the distribution alternatives, discussing costs, a thorough and open discussion of cost in the plan versus the IRA, is a big part of risk management in this area. And I think of what Brad said about Treasury easing the process for transferring money among plans is a desire on the part of the government to keep money inside plans at institutional pricing rather than rolled over to IRAs at retail pricing. So I think that's, if there's a bias in the system, I think that's the bias. Now, you can decide if that's a good bias or a bad bias, but I do think there is a bias there.
Yeah, I agree. That's clearly a bias, and I also think, though, that one of the concerns I have about where the Labor Department in particular has been going with its regulatory approach to IRA rollovers is, while there is a bias in that favor, and there are certainly good arguments to be made for why institutional pricing is a good thing, there are very real differences in terms of benefits and services that you get when you leave a plan and go to an IRA choice and a whole bunch of other things that may make that a very wise decision for certain participants. So one of my concerns is that the government not throw the baby out with the bathwater here and be so concerned about conflicts and so concerned about the bias in favor of institutional pricing that they lose track of the real need people have for some of the services they can get in the IRA sector that may not be available in the plan sector. There, I'll get off my soapbox.
No, I agree. I actually think that if you look at participant preferences, most participants want a human that they can talk to, and the push inside retirement plans is to push everybody to the Internet to lower costs even further. And so they want a human they can talk to. I think most participants also want what you might call holistic planning, financial planning, retirement planning, taking into account all of their assets and doing the planning, maybe even if you've got a fair amount of money, having your taxable assets in the right place versus your lower taxed assets. So I think that there is a great desire among people, and particularly among older people today who didn't grow up as kids with iPhones, to have somebody sit down with them and help them do the right thing. So I think there is a participant preference as well. Brad is going to be back to you for a couple of different bullet points on the agenda here. The next one is what the president's new budget proposal tells us about DOL investigations, IRS audits, and agency enforcement.
Sure. Well, you know, as you all probably know, the president released his budget here on March 4th, I believe it was, or right around that time frame. And it had a number of interesting provisions relating to retirement. Some of them obviously were policy proposals, the MyRA or MIRA or whatever you call it, and those sorts of things. But also if you look at the actual agencies, where is the money being requested? You know, what's the money being requested for? It can tell you a lot about what some of the priorities are. Now, if you look at the Department of Labor, they're asking for about a $10 million increase from $178 million to $188 million for their agency, which equates to predominantly most of that money would be going to hiring 32 new FTE, full-time equivalent. Not quite the same as a person, but the easiest way to think of it is 32 new employees, all of whom are going to be in the enforcement and participant assistance program. So in essence, they'd be bumping up to just shy of 900 of their staff that are devoted to enforcement and participant assistance.
That's total, right? There are rumors going around like the DOL is hiring 1,000 new enforcement people. And I mean, there's some ridiculous stuff floating around out there.
Yeah, those rumors are pretty persistent, despite the fact that each budget cycle we've reported that that's not in fact the case. There has been a significant increase in DOL enforcement assets, but it's on the order over 5 years of maybe 200 or so. So again, this year they're asking for an additional 32. Now, that's a not inconsequential number for the agency. That's a good increase. But the agency as a whole is asking for an authorization of 1,017 FTE. So, if the entire agency is less than 1,020 people, they're certainly not adding 1,000 new investigators. So, yeah, you're right. I keep hearing those rumors, too. They're not true. But it is true that the agency has been increasingly focusing on enforcement and devoting more and more resources there. And there has been an increase that is substantial compared to the agency, if not the kind of fanciful numbers that are thrown around. If we look over at the IRS side in the tax-exempt group, it's a smaller increase, but it's also there. They're really going to be focusing on the small business-sponsored plans and the tax-exempt group plans. They're looking to hire about an additional 12 agents there to go through and really focus on that space, do another, they estimate, 550 or so audits per year. So both agencies are focusing on enforcement and asking more. But just to put this in perspective for all of us who are working on the retirement side, let's just take one brief detour, and I promise I'll be brief, but just for the purpose of assisting taxpayers in understanding the new, individual portions of the Affordable Care Act tax situation and what that might mean for taxpayers, the IRS is looking to add 829 FTE. So there's almost the, 80% of the entire staff of EBSA. The equivalent of that is what the IRS is asking for to explain to individuals and handle issues with individuals relating to their new tax obligations in connection with the ACA. So I think that kind of helps just put a few things in perspective. I thought it was an interesting nugget to throw out there.
Do you want to move on to the president's retirement proposals?
Oh, sorry, yes. So you all have heard about the MyRA, which is I'm sure this isn't how the president would describe it, but in essence, it's sort of the automatic IRA proposal light. It's something they're seeking to achieve through executive order using their existing authority, they can't make it automatic enrollment because that would require legislation to deal with state payroll laws, et cetera. So they're looking to create a situation where they have the infrastructure for employers to offer payroll deduction IRAs that would invest in this new government debt instrument. And the idea is that it would get people up to $15,000, and then it would be shunted off into the private sector as a Roth IRA. But their goal there behind this is to capture that portion of the workforce, and estimates vary, but I think 25 or so percent is a pretty good estimate, of those people who work for an employer but don't have access to any sort of a retirement plan at work. And so that's the goal there. The president also reproposed the automatic IRA proposal in its entirety, which is, you know, again, kind of a similar idea. The difference would be that the automatic IRA would require legislation and would be a mandate on employers above a certain size to have to offer a payroll deduction IRA. And so you can see that the MyRA proposal is sort of laying the groundwork for automatic enrollment should it ever, automatic IRA enrollment should it ever be done. The president's budget continues the aggregate cap on the amount one can accumulate in all of the different sorts of defined contribution and other plans they have. Again, the notion behind it is this aggregate cap on accumulation would be the actuarial equivalent of the current cap on the income that can be generated by a traditional defined benefit plan, which is, you know, the annuity income, which is this year $210,000. That equates to a cap of about $3.2 to $3.4 million. One interesting thing is even though this proposal is really largely unchanged, there are a few tweaks, but it's largely unchanged from last year, it does now magically raise three times as much money for the budget, up from about $9 billion to about $28 billion. So I'll let the government explain how that happened, but I think you all are relatively familiar with this proposal because of last year. It raises a lot of real procedural concerns were it ever to become law. How would one actually track these aggregated amounts across different accounts that the employer wouldn't be aware of? What would be the burdens on employers to deal with excess contributions and returning them and all of the issues that present? And then, of course, the other big deal is since this cap is the actuarial equivalent of a current income stream from an annuity, when interest rates grow up, that's certainly going to significantly impact what that cap can be and bring it down. So as a policy matter, I think there are a lot of questions and concerns about it. A couple of changes to Roth IRAs. The president's proposed that there would be no contributions after age 70 and a half, and you would have to start taking the required minimum distributions at 70 and a half, which is a fairly substantial change, I think, given what a lot of people have used Roths for in their retirement planning. And they would also propose getting rid of stretch IRAs. There is one exception to that required minimum distribution. They wouldn't require it for an IRA with less than $100,000 total. That's kind of in a nutshell the biggest ones, although one thing I should have mentioned, if you are above the 28% tax bracket, you would nonetheless only be able to contribute as if you were in the 28% tax bracket. There would be an additional surtax on top for those extra contributions that would, I think, in essence, be double taxation. Fred, do you have any thoughts on the budget?
You know, Brad, this is a quick one to put this in context. Why don't you tell the people what you think the odds are of this passing this year, and then go on and tell them why we talked about it.
Okay. Well, first of all, as probably all of you know, every president's budget, no matter which party controls the White House or Congress, is dead on arrival. The budget itself is never enacted as it's presented. However, it's important because it does lay out some of the policy priorities that the administration has, and it gives you a flavor for where they're going to be when negotiations occur on actual issues. So the document itself isn't significant as a budget proposal, but it is significant for a lot of the policy pronouncements. Now, is it likely that there's going to be comprehensive tax reform such that there's actually a vehicle for most of these proposals to be attached to? And we have the same thing for Chairman Camp's tax reform proposal, which I'll mention in a minute. Neither the president's budget nor Chairman Camp's proposal are going to become law, so or at least not in 2014. So you know, it's very, very unlikely. So you would say, as Fred just did, well, why are we talking about it? We're talking about it because in the context of overall tax reform, the retirement policy is not what's driving things. And we need to look at the retirement policy positions that are taken by the primary negotiators here to see how much of what we currently have in our tax policy for retirement is being threatened. And it's a pretty significant risk in some of these proposals. And it's something we need to be aware of because how you address the tax incentives for offering plans, particularly at the small business level, could really impact how many plans there are, how available they are, the rules we all operate under. The desire to find revenue causes policymakers to look at the retirement sector not as as it should be, not as with an eye really towards its own policy, but more as an eye towards how much money can we take from the tax preferences for retirement plans, and how much damage does it do, and do we care? And that's unfortunately why it's important to take a look at this. So, Fred, maybe I should just segue over to Chairman Camp's proposal.
And then go right out of that into the DOL and the 408B2 guide.
Yeah, we'll do that. Because we don't want to spend an excessive amount of time here talking about probably the tax policy. But I think Chairman Camp's proposal is important to note because it is, he's the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. He's put out a overall comprehensive tax reform policy that has some pretty substantial and I think pretty negative provisions for retirement plans. The two that I'd single out in particular is one, he proposed taking the total amount you can contribute, $17,500 for a worker in that age group, and splitting it, where the first half up to $8,750 would be traditional pre-tax, the second half would be Roth only. So right there, that's going to change the tax incentives for folks who are making those contributions. Secondly, he would propose freezing the indexing, the increase in that $17,500, for 10 years. So there'd be no additional increases. So just to put that in perspective, they think that raises about $63 billion in revenue to freeze the maximum level of elective contributions for 10 years. If you just do a quick ballpark back-of-the-envelope estimate, what does that mean? Well, that means that if $63 billion in revenue is saved by not letting that amount increase, ballpark about $150 to $180 billion in contributions aren't made in order to achieve that savings. That's a pretty big hit, even over 10 years, for retirement savings at a time when all the policymakers are simultaneously saying, gee, Americans aren't saving enough for retirement. There would be no additional contributions to traditional IRAs under the Camp proposal. The traditional IRA would be only a rollover vehicle from a qualified plan, but no new traditional IRAs. There would be no new SEPs or SIMPLs. The stretch IRAs would also be prohibited, and he would also make some proposals to change some of the non-qualified plans, which is a slightly different issue, but one that's probably important to a lot of folks on this call. You add all that up, and again, not to dwell on it, but when the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee is offering something that's not very friendly to retirement plans, and the president's also offering something that makes some changes that we're not going to like, that's not a good place to be as a negotiating matter. Now, fortunately, that won't happen this year. In 2015, Mr. Camp will no longer be chairman of the Ways and Means Committee because of term limits, so things will be different. But nonetheless, it's important to really understand that the forces in Washington that look at revenue are not looking at revenue with an eye towards good retirement policy, but rather gathering revenue. So let's segue on to the first real regulatory proposal that the Department of Labor has put out this year. It's the new guide that would accompany certain 408B2 disclosures. So as you all probably recall, 408B2 went into effect July of 12, and it requires covered service providers, and just in a nutshell, those are the fiduciaries to plans, as well as most service providers who receive payment in relation to the plan from someone other than the plan, indirect compensation. And the current rule for disclosures is that those disclosures can be provided across a number of documents. They don't have to be in a particular format, as long as in the aggregate all of the information has been provided to the responsible plan fiduciary, that is the plan fiduciary selecting the service provider. As long as all that information in the aggregate has been provided reasonably in advance of entering into the arrangement, then compliance is there. DOL is concerned, though, that some of the documents they've reviewed are very, very lengthy. Some are in multiple documents, as I said, across different disclosures. And they're concerned, they, DOL, are concerned that plan fiduciaries, particularly smaller plan fiduciaries, aren't able to get the information they need to actually understand those disclosures. And so for the new proposal, they're basically saying if you, the service provider, are offering either very lengthy or multiple document disclosures, then you're going to have to provide a guide that shows the plan fiduciary where to find the key information they need to understand those disclosures. Now, there's a couple of interesting things about the way DOL has proposed this regulation, and one of them I would say is, in my experience, it's rather unusual to see a DOL regulation where the proposal identifies a variable but doesn't suggest a number for it. So what I mean by that is, what is a lengthy disclosure document? Well, DOL is saying we want your comments on what the page number should be to define a lengthy disclosure document. So instead of suggesting one, they're asking for comment on it. Now, that's both good and bad. I mean, that's good in that I think it helps us in responding to this proposal to be able to offer suggestions and rationales for why disclosures are particular lengths based on what DOL is requiring to be disclosed. But it also means that we won't actually see their conclusion about what a correct page number is possibly until the final regulation down the road is proposed. Now, I suspect DOL will be more transparent than that and will actually give some suggestions as to what it's thinking before we get there. But it is an interesting and somewhat unusual way for them to do that. So one of the big questions people are going to be answering in the comments is what is lengthy and how does that go? Another issue is, okay, so in this guide that we would have to produce by virtue of having a lengthy or multiple document disclosure, the guide is pointing people to what? Is it pointing them to a specific page, to a particular section of our disclosure elsewhere? And is that sufficiently clear for the fiduciary to find that information? And again, DOL is saying rather than us define that it means page 12, subparagraph A, you know, 3 little bi, we want you to instead give us some comments on what should be sufficiently close to the information as an identifier in this guide to find it. In other words, is a page number enough? Is a section enough? How much more precise does it have to be? And further to go through this, when DOL is a little bit down the road, they're also going to seek comment in the form of specific focus groups. With 100 small plan sponsors, presumably small plan sponsors, where they're going to ask those plan fiduciaries questions about different forms of disclosure to try and see what it is those small plan fiduciaries really want in a disclosure and what's really helpful. So this is a potentially pretty significant disclosure. I mean, I think DOL has estimated the cost to be between $7 and $22 million. I think most folks in the regulated community will assume that that is really, really low compared to what it'll actually cost, but that's part of the comment as well, is to get back to the DOL on why what they propose will or will not significantly increase costs to plans ultimately as service providers work to comply with it. Fred, any thoughts?
A couple. One is a couple of the attorneys in my firm, including me, have written an alert on it, an article about it, and we're sending it out to everybody on our service provider database today. So many of you all will get that, and it goes into more detail than we have time to go into today. So if you aren't on our service provider mailing list and you want to be, then email me, fred.reisch@dbr.com, and I'll put you on it. Secondly, I think it's going to affect different types of service providers very differently. And I'm going to talk in broad generalities here because there are exceptions to everything. But for the most part, my experience is that RIAs and compliance only, that is non-record-keeping, TPAs, have their disclosures in a single document that is not lengthy. And therefore, on the whole, those two groups won't be affected at all by this change. Now, there are exceptions. There are people who use multiple documents, so that's just a general statement. The third major group of covered service providers are broker-dealers. They're going to have probably the hardest job of dealing with this. And without going into the details of why, I suspect that the outcome will be that many of them, perhaps most of them, are going to probably contract out with third-party service providers to make disclosures in the future. That's just too hard, unless you're a very, very large organization, to develop the software and the processes to be able to do this when you're using multiple documents, like prospectuses that can change from day to day. A year from now, the prospectus might be changed. It might move to another page. Similarly, record keepers are going to have to do a lot of work on this because they tend to use multiple documents because of the volume of their disclosures. The key thing is one thing that Brad mentioned, which is what the DOL calls the locator. There has to be some reference to where the responsible plan fiduciary, the company, the employer, can find the services described, the fiduciary status, if it exists, and the compensation to be paid direct and indirect. And that locator, the DOL has suggested, should be page specific. On such and such a page of such and such a document, you will find this. And you'll find 12B1 fees, you'll find revenue sharing, you'll find whatever. The problem is that if you're using multiple documents like prospectuses prepared by other people, it's very hard to have a system that the locator is specific to each of those documents. So that, to me, is the big issue. If there's going to be a technical fight on this whole thing, it's going to be about the locator. That, to my mind, is what it all boils down to. Right now, there are none. The DOL has suggested one alternative. Where is that going to end up? I think if that can be worked out, then this will be much less of a problem for service providers than we think. But having said that, I think it's going to be extremely difficult to work that out. Brad?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And so, again, as I said, there's the good and the bad here. DOL, I think, is open to finding a way to solve those technical issues and do this, even as they're committed, though, to requiring this process to move forward. So, the process they put forward through this proposal and the amount of comments they're taking and sort of in some cases, a case where they haven't clearly identified what their preference is something we have to take into account in the comments and do a very thorough job in responding to.
Let's move on to some of the other regulatory issues that the DOL is looking at. We've got about 10, 11 minutes before we're going to open it up for questions. So let me move through this fairly quickly because I want to get to a court decision that came down yesterday. The DOL has what's called a regulatory agenda, and they list what they're going to be working on and hope to issue this year. In addition to the things we've already talked about, they are looking at finalizing their disclosure rules for target date funds. By and large, their proposed regulations, both for participant disclosures and for the QDIA safe harbor disclosures, are non-controversial. They focus on asset allocation and glide path as the information to be given. At the same time, the SEC is working on guidance that they have previously issued in proposed form. And guess what? It focuses on asset allocation and glide path. Similarly, industry commentators who filed comments for the DOL have focused on asset allocation and glide path. So what it's all coming down to is a thorough explanation to plan fiduciaries and participants about asset allocation at the current time, at the targeted date, and when it hits its most conservative point, which in effect becomes the main part of the glide path. To me, that means if you're a plan sponsor listening to this, or if you're an advisor to plan sponsors listening to this, you need to be having robust conversations documented in the committee minutes about asset allocation and glide path. And the minute you say this is the asset allocation and glide path of the target date fund family in your plan, the next question would be, well, what are other people doing, or sort of what's the average? And that gets you to a discussion of two things: conservative asset allocations, moderate asset allocations, and aggressive asset allocations. That's one. Is your asset allocation aggressive, conservative, or moderate, focusing on the last 10 years, that is the 10 years preceding the targeted date? The second discussion that should be documented in the committee minutes is the glide path. Is it to retirement or through retirement? That is, does it hit its most conservative point at the targeted retirement date, or does it continue to get more conservative thereafter? Why did the fiduciaries think that one or the other was appropriate for their plan? For example, if everybody retires and takes a cash distribution at their retirement date, why do you have a through glide path if nobody's using it? Is the employer, are the fiduciaries suggesting to the participants that they should continue to be invested in that same target date fund in their IRAs because it's Otherwise, they would never get advantage of the glide path. Have they thought about that? I just, regardless of whether you agree or disagree with some of my suggestions about the implications, I don't think there can be any disagreement about the fact you have to look at the asset allocation and you have to look at the glide path. I think it's sort of the beginning and the end of that one. Also, there's a proposal to send out an RFI, a request for information, on brokerage windows. Without going into the full rich history of this, the DOL has thought that plan sponsors were prudently selecting and monitoring the providers of brokerage windows to their 401k plans. But for the most part, my experience has been that the plan fiduciaries, committee members, sort of view brokerage windows as sandboxes, that the investment sandboxes that interested participants can use totally on their own with no oversight at all. And without the committee particularly being concerned about what's going on in the brokerage account or about the expenses that are being incurred for the investments. So you have a conflict between what plan sponsors have perceived and what the DOL has perceived. And what this is really all about is it's the first step in the regulation of the fiduciary responsibilities for brokerage windows. We don't know enough to see where it's going, but I don't know, Brad, do you feel like you have any insights into the DOL thinking that might foretell the future a little on this?
Yeah, it is hard to predict. I mean, if you look at the history of this issue, which relates back to some guidance DOL issued in connection with the participant disclosure reg, you could say, well, they're just looking at the narrow issue of are the disclosures related to brokerage windows sufficient to let participants exercise their ability to select investments? You know, it's consistent with the new fiduciary obligation of the plan administrator to give those disclosures, and is particularly focusing on brokerage window-only plans. In other words, a plan where there aren't a lot of core investment options, there's just a bunch of brokerage windows, which is, I think, a fairly uncommon plan design, but something DOL seems to be particularly worried about. If you go just with the disclosures they put out or the guidance they put out in connection with the participant rule, then you would think it would be limited to that. I personally think it's going to be more broad-ranging because with an RFI, they have a chance to ask about everything. And, you know, sort of from soup to nuts, what are these things, how are they being used, who's picking them, exactly what's going on. And I think that's the opportunity they'll take. And I think the responses they get will dictate in large measure how broad their response is.
Okay, well, good. The third regulatory item I wanted to talk about was the proposal that's being developed that I believe will say that plan sponsors, plan fiduciaries, have to provide retirement income projections on quarterly statements for participants. I think if that does get proposed and then with comments and then ultimately becomes final a year later or so, that it could be a game changer in the 401k area in two ways. One way is that it could increase savings because participants could be worried about benefit adequacy. The second way is that it would be a door opener for talking about different products and services that provide secure income in retirement, either really secure, like annuities or other insurance company guarantees, or somewhat secure, like professional investment management or even retirement income mutual funds. But I think this is the beginning of a movement in a direction towards secure retirement income. And I do think it will become final, ultimately. That's my best bet. But we'll have to wait and see. I mean, they're working on it. They've gone through a long process. They really want to get this right at the Department of Labor. A couple of years ago, they issued a request for information. They got that. A year ago, there was an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, which says, hey, we're sort of thinking about this. What do you think about? Now we're going to a proposed regulation. That is a long and thorough process that we don't often see in the development of guidance. So obviously, the Department of Labor is taking this very, very seriously. Brad, are there one or two things I left out, including the fiduciary regulation? You want to add any comments?
My personal view is that on the fiduciary regulation, that though it's scheduled for August, we'll probably not see it until after the congressional midterm election in November. And I think my personal, as we've talked about before, I'm personally rather pessimistic on where this goes. I think it ends up looking an awful lot like the original, although with some new privative transaction exemptions. particularly, say, for principal transactions for broker-dealers. But otherwise is quite substantially the same and may, in fact, even go further on some of the IRA rollover issues and kind of open a new front of discussion. So I think this fight is one that we're going to really spend a lot more time on after the election. So I think we should all stay tuned.
Yeah, I agree with Brad. I can't imagine issuing a regulation that will be this controversial shortly before an election. That's almost like asking for trouble. But who knows? We'll see. Let's move on to the court decision that came down yesterday, and we'll spend about 5 minutes on it, and we'll open it up for questions. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled on the ABB Fidelity appeal yesterday. And in the interest of time, I'm going to mention the 2 points that I think are the most important, and then we'll leave it at that and go to Q&As. On the first issue, which was that the plan committee allowed the record keeper to receive too much compensation for their services, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeal affirmed the trial court. In other words, they affirmed the trial court decision that the payments to the record keepers were to the record keeper was excessive. My recollection is that was in the range of $13 million of damages. So that's now affirmed, and there's still some potential appeals. There can be appeal to the Supreme Court, although that doesn't tend to be the kind of case that I think the Supreme Court would hear. They could ask for what's called an en banc hearing at the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, meaning that instead of just three judges, that all the judges in the circuit hear the case. But again, it's such a fact-intensive issue. I have a hard time imagining that moving on. Having said that, I'm not a litigator, so that's just a best guess. The second issue was that, let me say, I think the moral of that first issue, the moral of the story was, we now have a circuit court of appeal that says, you really do have to monitor the compensation of the record keeper and other service providers. And if a committee doesn't do that, they can be liable. They can be liable in fairly big numbers, depending on how far they are off what's reasonable. So I think for those of you who are advisors to committees, this is certainly something you should mention to them. If you're having a hard time getting them to benchmark the compensation of their service providers, say, here's what happened to a committee that actually got a benchmark but then didn't apply it. They didn't figure out how much the record keeper was actually making and compare it to that, according to the facts of the case. I have no idea if that's true or not, but that's how it's reported. The second issue was where the investment policy statement said that in order to remove a fund, it had to be placed on the watch list. It had to be there, I think it was for some prescribed period, like 6 months, and then if it didn't satisfy the IPS standards, it could be removed. I'm oversimplifying that, and I might even be off a little bit, but I'm not off on the big point, which is that the IPS had a procedure specified in it, and the allegations and the trial court decision were that the IPS didn't get followed. The Court of Appeals remanded, and I'll explain what that means. But before I do that, the Court of Appeals looked at this, and I said, the trial court said that the investment policy statement is a document governing the operation of the plans, and therefore under ERISA, unless it would be imprudent to do so, the committee had to follow the terms of the IPS. My recollection is that's also the DOL position, isn't it, Brad?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a fair statement.
Yeah, and so but then the trial court said, we're reluctant to say that the IPS is a document governing the operation of the plan, but we don't have to decide that now, so we won't decide it. So they threw their hands up on that, left it for the future. But then they went on to say that, and it appears, again, there's some holes in the opinion, but it appears that the committee argued, we interpreted the document, and our interpretation was it was okay to do what we did. And the Court of Appeals said, the interpretation of a plan document, we believe, this particular Court of Appeals believes, is not subject to the prudent man standard, but instead subject to the abuse of discretion standard. In other words, they don't have to, any reasonable any rational interpretation is acceptable under the abuse of discretion standard. So it's not the best interpretation, not the most likely interpretation, but any reasonable interpretation. So if there are five different ways it could be read, any one of those five are fine. And they remanded it to the trial court to re-decide that. So we don't know if the plan sponsor won or lost it, or if the plaintiffs won or lost it. We're going to have to wait and see on that one. So everything being said and done, what do I think the story is? I think the story is you got to monitor the compensation of service providers, and you have to have market data to do that. And the rest of it is interesting, but when we walk away from the case, that's what we have to take away from it for the time being.
I would just add one more thing about the IPS there. Regardless of where this court comes down, ultimately, on whether it's a governing document of the plan, you are well advised to treat it as if it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's going to give some people the wrong impression. I think Brad has exactly the right impression. Having said that, Melissa, it's time to go to questions and answers, so why don't you open up the lines?
Certainly, ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question at this time, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're on a speakerphone, please make sure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Please be aware that a voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open. Once again, for questions at this time, please press star 1 now. And we do have a question in the queue.
Hi there.
Yes, am I talking to you, Fred?
Yeah.
Yeah, one quick question. In terms of cost, most plans under $10 million, which is a vast majority of plans, do not have institutional pricing. And has anybody in the government ever heard of opportunity cost? My question is, we're not dealing with reality here. Is there any point in trying to educate the people who are making these decisions about what really is going on?
Yeah, I mean, there's an opportunity to comment on this. From a policy perspective, I think what they're really saying is participants have four alternatives. They can leave the money in their current plan. They can transfer it to the plan of a new employer. They can take a taxable distribution. Or they can roll it over to an IRA. And that they want to make sure that there is a clear explanation to all of the participants about that, and that they understand what their alternatives are, and that the advisors are having a discussion with them, and that the advisors are treating leaving it in the plan with the same deference that they're treating it rolling over to an IRA. And the pricing is part of that. I would say the main difference if for small plans on the institutional pricing side is you don't tend to have front-end loads on IRAs, IRAs, if you just have $50,000 or $100,000 or $200,000, you could end up paying up front-end loads. Remember, this is FINRA, so they're thinking about the broker-dealer as their regulated community. And there could be front-end loads. But I think that the outcome of this, in some cases, if you work with very large plans, which have huge percentage of the overall participants, as opposed to the number of plans, they do get institutional pricing, and they ought to be told that that's what it's about. And they ought to be told about these different considerations. In other words, it puts a much greater burden on the advisor to educate participants, with one possible outcome being the advisor doesn't get to manage the money because the participant says, hey, I never realized it, but I got a pretty good deal on the plan. I think I'll leave it there. Having said that, I don't think that will be the normal outcome, though. I think most people want a sense of ownership. That is, they want to feel like they own their money. They don't feel like they own it when it's in a plan, at least nowadays. And maybe that'll change in the future. And then the other is they want holistic planning. They really want to be able to talk to their advisor and say, here's all my assets. What do I do with them? How do I make them last for my lifetime? Help me with my financial planning. Help me out here. And so I think that that most people will continue to roll over, but there's going to be a lot of work about whether or not they should be taking a distribution from a plan.
I wanted to speak to the bias. I don't want to take any more time about this, but the whole notion that all of us out here, we're really evil and we're trying to take advantage of all these poor souls, it's just baloney.
Yeah, well, I think that's true. Go ahead, Brad.
I certainly agree. I would just say, even when you get annoyed and think, why is it worth my time to try and tell these people what really happens, it's actually essential that you take your time and tell the government what's happening in the marketplace as you experience it. Because they don't know. No matter how well-intentioned a regulator is, they're not out in the field doing the things that you're doing. And so taking the time to make a comment really is worthwhile. It is going to be read. Now, can I say it's going to sway them? Not necessarily, but it might. But at the end of the day, you're giving them data they don't have necessarily about what's going on. And that is to all of our benefit, to provide as much information to the regulators as possible so that they're not operating from a false premise.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I want to echo what Brad said, that I've gone and talked to the government about issues, you know, not these major headline issues like we're talking about right now, but about other issues of importance, and been told I was the only person who talked to them about it, or the only one of five people that had talked to them about it. And, you know, by getting involved, you can have a lot more influence than you would think just being one person. You because not that many people actually will go to the government and speak up. So
I'll give it a try.
Yeah, and your trade associations tend to do a pretty good job too. So anyway, great, thank you very much.
And ladies and gentlemen, once again, if you'd like to ask a question at this time, please press star one now. And we do have another question in the queue.
Hi there.
Hi, Fred. And Brad, I have a question regarding a recent act that was proposed by Tom Harkin. We're seeing in a number of instances states are either adopting or very much considering putting into place their own version of a MIRA or a MIRA. We have that in California with the California Secure Act that's been mandated. It hasn't really been effected yet, but the question that I have, and the whole idea is to create not only an opportunity for individuals to have some sort of retirement or savings plan within their employment, but also to recognize that some of the smaller businesses, it's an expensive proposition to have a 401k. This could be the IRA approach, could be one way of doing that. And the whole idea is to be able to do it at a low cost and also not to have to assume a fiduciary responsibility because it is outside of the confines of ERISA. In Harkin's bill, the proposed bill, he mentioned that in this, individuals would be able to contribute up to $10,000 per year pre-tax, but employers would also be able to contribute up to $5,000 per year for each employee. Wouldn't that constitute some sort of a fiduciary responsibility if they get to touching that? I sort of, you know, pun intended, harken back to the 403B in the old days when, as long as you just created a pay slot as an employer and didn't touch it, didn't do anything that would constitute fiduciary activity, you were just fine. I'm a little confused by this, and I think it's important only because we're seeing all of these new schemes emerging amongst a lot of the states, and I think it has to be done right, or there's going to be some real confusion and could hurt, you know, both employers and employees.
Brad, this is really more in your area than mine.
Yeah, no, I absolutely share your concerns. Really, they're two separate proposals, and they work differently. So let's focus on the states first. There are a number of states that are starting to go down that road saying, well, you know, maybe what we could do is open up some sort of state-based plan where the employer just hooks in and we run that. I think the real risk there is that you're going to end up potentially with a whole bunch of states doing things quite differently in a way that's going to make it very difficult sort of at an overall level to deal with all those differences, sort of the balkanization of the retirement space. And I think a number of those, personally, I think a number of those state efforts are probably preempted by ERISA. Now, will this administration actually take the view that it is preempted and go to somewhere like California and start litigating against them? Well, that's a political question, so we'll see what happens there. The Harkin proposal is different in that he's really setting up a whole new national system with kind of these new national investment pools that are run by committees of, you know, different compositions. And if I understand his bill correctly, the fact that an employer contributes would not necessarily result in that employer fiduciary standard, because he's really reforming the whole system. I'll say this about Senator Harkin's bill. I think it's unlikely to go very far. I view it as an interesting proposal, but not one that's in any way imminent. By contrast, some of these state actions are potentially quite imminent, and so it's an area I think we do need to really look at.
Well, Brad and all of y'all, we've reached our allotted time. Jim, why don't you bring this thing to a close?
Certainly. I just want to thank both you, Fred, and Brad for the discussion today. I think we all found it very valuable. And on behalf of Natixis Global Asset Management and Drinker Biddle, I want to thank everyone who chose to join the call today. And on your calendars, please mark June 5th as the next date for the Inside the Beltway discussion. I'm sure there'll be a few emails to follow just to firm that up. And Melissa, thank you for facilitating the call. If you'd like, you can close it out.
Thank you. That does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for your participation.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.